Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming today. I did have to check my watch. It is morning still, and it is lovely to see all of you here. You braved the elements. Give yourselves a round of applause for that, huh? January in Iowa. Well, as ICFRC's executive director, I want to thank you once again for coming out. We really appreciate you all being here today. We are an organization that is run by individuals who have shaped and made this organization successful for now 40 years. So I want to thank you for being here, and without further ado, our host for today, Sunday Goshet.
Thank you, Peter. Peter has welcomed you, and so I want to emphasize again that you're welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council program featuring Sarah Telau and Amarance Makunda on the topic of working with refugees and displaced persons, the IRC in Iowa. I want to thank you for joining us in person and those of you who are live streamed today. My name, like Peter said, is Sunday Goshet. I am an IFRC board member, and I'm your host for today's program. This year marks Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's 40th anniversary. I thought that deserved an applause. We are celebrating our supporters, legacy in the community, and the bright future ahead of internationally focused programming in Iowa City. We want you to check our website, sign up for our monthly newsletter, and follow us on social media to learn more about the exciting events happening this year. Iowa City Foreign Relations Council wants to acknowledge and thank its donors, sponsors, and partners for their support. And among others, it includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxis Plus, City Channel 4 for providing online access to our programs along with the UI Library Archives. And last, but not the least, actually with great gratitude, the Iowa City Public Library for their partnership, providing our new home, and for the refreshments served today. It's amazing. And we're very grateful for the long-standing support from those of you in our community who have helped our organization grow for 40 years. As a small nonprofit, we're primarily funded by the generosity of individuals. I hope you will consider making a financial contribution here today by scanning one of our QR codes in the room or by visiting our website later. Iowa City Foreign Relations Council has adopted the Native American land acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Human Rights Commission. The Iowa City Foreign Relations Council recognizes that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homelands of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. The full text of our acknowledgement is on our website at icfrc.org. I'd now like to introduce our speakers. Sarah Telau is the Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Iowa. Before joining the Iowa team, Sarah held the same position in Northern California and Kansas, overseeing diverse programs that offered services to refugees, immigrants, asylees, survivors of trafficking, and other vulnerable populations. Before joining the IRC in the US, Sarah spent 15 years overseas in conflict-affected settings, overseeing health, nutrition, women's empowerment, education, economic empowerment, and water and sanitation programs in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, I just learned of that now. Central African Republic, Rwanda, and Mali. Sarah holds a Master's of Public Health and a Master's of Social Work from Columbia University. She is fluent in English and French and is working hard to improve her Spanish. Can we clap for Sarah? Amerence Makunda, a graduate of Kirkwood Community College, is a housing specialist for the Iowa for the International Rescue Committee, IRC, in Des Moines, Iowa. Previously, she was a cultural liaison for the Iowa City Community Schools District. She has served as an AmeriCorps member with IC Compassion and has worked in various professional capacities in Iowa, including with Goodwill of the Heartland. And she has provided years of support to newcoming families in Iowa and Iowa City community, including helping them understand the U.S. school system, and if needed, helping them secure local employment, health insurance, and housing. I'm very privileged to have worked with Amerence in some of those capacities. Please join me in welcoming Sarah Tello and Amerence Makunda, who will talk about working with refugees and displaced persons, the International Rescue Committee in Iowa. Sarah and Amerence, over to you.
Yeah. Okay. I think these are on. Sounds like it. So I'm Sarah, and thank you for the introduction. I'll kick us off and do a lot of the sort of background of the International Rescue Committee and some of the work that we do internationally and then here in the U.S. And then we'll pass it to Amerence to share a bit of her own story coming from DRC and how she found her pathway to arrive into Iowa City. I'm going to try to navigate my laptop and this screens at the same time. So that's just a quick overview of the agenda. We'll do our best to keep at least 15-20 minutes for questions. So we'll do our best. So quickly about the IRC. We were founded at the request of Albert Einstein to support Germans suffering under Hitler. So we are nearly a 100-year-old organization. We will celebrate our 100th anniversary in 2033. And our mission, our core mission, has always been to serve populations fleeing violence and conflict. In recent years, we have started to support those impacted and displaced due to climate change. But our core mandate has always been to support those impacted by war and crisis. Okay. So we work in 52 countries, I think, today. Tomorrow it may be a different number, because we very much focus, again, on the sort of emerging conflict countries. And so we'll go into a new country when a crisis may erupt. But currently, we're in 50-plus countries internationally. And we have about 30 offices in the United States where we do refugee resettlement. We also work in Europe. We have a lot of sort of, we have fundraising offices in Europe. We have coordination offices in Europe. We also do refugee resettlement through our Germany program, who resettled a lot of Syrians and other populations. We also work in Greece and Italy. For example, with people who have fled by boat across the Mediterranean. So we have very diverse programs across the world. Okay. So I'll talk a little bit about our international programs. Again, we work in conflict and post-conflict. That's where most of our focus has been as an organization. We do some development work, so that's in countries that have not experienced conflict, but we do more long-term sort of sustainable growth, focused on education often, governance, programming, those sorts of things. But we're very conflict-focused. Just for an example, we've been in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, for nearly 30 years. It's one of our largest and longest-running programs. We have done development work. We have done acute humanitarian response work all across the country for decades. We also, for example, have just gained or are seeking to gain entry into Gaza, as well into Egypt, where some of the population is fleeing. We were very quick to go into countries surrounding Ukraine when the Ukraine crisis kicked off. So we have programs now in Poland, for example. We have a program in Afghanistan for 20 plus years. So we again pivoted and did emergency response programming when there was the fall of Kabul and the Afghans fled, many coming to the United States. So those are some of our international programs. This is one of our doctors during an Ebola response in the DRC, just unloading some of our medical supplies. Okay. Again, we do what we call acute onset emergency. We did this in Afghanistan, in Ukraine. I was in the DRC. I spent 7 years there in total. I was there during two Ebola outbreaks. And so we did an emergency response to set up, we brought in doctors and nurses, set up clinics, set up treatment centers to respond to the Ebola outbreak. So we have a whole emergency team that will come in and deploy who are experts in sort of starting off a new program in a conflict. They came into the Congo where we already had programming and then helped to set up very quickly our Ebola response programming. Same thing in Central African Republic. I worked there for 2 years. There was actually a government overthrow during that time. We had existing development programming, so we were doing very long-term supporting the government in education, in health. And overnight, almost literally, we had to shift to tens of thousands of displaced people fleeing into churches, actually. And so we had to set up latrines, set up water bladders so that people who had fled and were hiding basically or seeking protection in these church compounds had food, water, place to go to the bathroom, et cetera. And so we will have an emergency team deploy their experts. They come in and can respond to those sorts of situations. So here's just a photograph. We work a lot with the local emergency responders. In Poland, we worked with the Polish Red Cross to support Ukrainians when they fled into Poland. Okay. So then we do more with post-conflict recovery. We also work in refugee camps, which are in many cases have been there for decades. And we do a lot more that's viewed as more sustainable. So we'll work with the Ministry of Education to provide education services. We will work with the government, the Ministry of Health to do health programming, and all of that aims to do longer term support. Also, when I was, I'm giving examples, when I worked in Eastern Congo, we did a lot of refugee repatriation back into Congo. So people had fled to Burundi, Congolese had fled to Burundi, had fled to Tanzania, and we helped, when Congo became safer, we helped those populations return. So with the Tanzanian Congolese, or the Congolese who were in Tanzania, they actually came back by boat across Lake Tanganyika, and we were there to meet them on the Congolese side. They literally came off the boat first time in Congo. For some of the kids, it was they'd never been home. They'd never been in Congo. They were born in a refugee camp. So the families were coming back after 10, 15 years in camps. We received them. They walked off the boat, and we received them and then helped them start to integrate and go back to their home villages. Okay. I'll switch and speak now more about what's a little more relevant and US-based. We work in, I believe, 30 offices across 15 to 20 states in the US. You can see the map here. Some of these locations have been open for 40, 50 years. The IRC had an office, still does have an office in Miami. We helped Cubans fleeing in the 1950s, for example. We have had an office in San Jose, California since the 70s and resettled a lot of the Vietnamese refugees who fled during the Vietnam War. So we are well established and have worked in the United States for decades, even though a lot of the focus is always on our international programming. Okay. So this is just a snapshot, and the slide's a little weird. I couldn't get the formatting right. So this is just a snapshot of the populations that we serve in the United States. There's a sort of brief definitions under each, but it gets quite complex. Having worked overseas for my whole career, even though I was born in Iowa, I grew up on a farm near Grinnell, my whole career was working internationally. And so coming back to the US was an education. I didn't really understand the political setup and how to advocate with politicians for refugee rights. I didn't understand how complex those that we serve can be in the US and how they're all defined very differently, people who have fled conflict. And each of those groups has a clear definition and a clear parameter of what we can and cannot do to support and serve those populations. So this is just some of the complexities. There's a lot more detail that I could go into. But again, in the US, we primarily work with refugees. So those who fled to another country, not their home country. And then they are granted permission to come to the US before they arrive. So that's our largest population. We also work with special immigrant visa holders. Those would be the Afghan population that came 2-3 years ago because they are special immigrant visa holders because they helped the US military or the US government in some way. And so Iraqis and Afghans are part of that group, and we offer services to many from those countries. Then there are humanitarian parolees, which is another category. They can be Afghan, Ukrainian, Haitian, Cuban, Venezuelan. There's a lot of populations that have humanitarian parole who can receive a certain set of services based on how the US defines them. We also work with asylum seekers who do not have permanent legal status. They have applied to remain in the US after arriving in the US. We work with this population. We work with asylees. And we also work with undocumented. We are starting a program working with undocumented in Iowa, but this is something we've done for years, decades in other countries, especially Southern California, Arizona, Texas. Most of our programming is with undocumented. Okay. I keep looking. I just want to make sure I'm speed talking a little bit so I can make sure I give time. We often use this quote. It may be, some of you may have heard it already. We use it a lot in sort of our sector of work, that I think the average refugee, the last statistic was 17 years is the average amount of time they spend in a refugee camp before their situation changes. There are certainly generations who live in refugee camps. There are children who grow into adulthood who were born in refugee camps. That's the situation for many populations across the world. I worked in Congolese refugee camps in Rwanda, and they had been in existence for close to 30 years, and they had no prospects of returning. So it was, but the Rwandan government would not integrate them. So basically they're stuck in this endless refugee status that will never change, unless there's something dramatic shifts in Congo. And then you have very new refugee camps. Again, what's Ukraine, a lot where they'll flee the border, I'm trying to think, Sudan, anywhere where there's been recent conflict, essentially there will be these new refugee camps. And then you have to find the land, you have to set up latrines and water and get food distributions going. So they really are very vast and diverse with different histories, the refugee camps across the world. And so that's where, but those refugee camps, which are run usually by United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, it's called UNHCR. UNHCR usually runs these camps in partnership with maybe an NGO, an international nonprofit. And so that is also how the refugees start their trip to come to the US or Germany or Sweden or Canada, or wherever they may be placed. Just a quick word on the admission process to come to the United States. Oop, thank you. I put the slide up just to sort of demonstrate, and the next slide as well, how complex the process is. But you know, the word refugee has been deeply politicized in the last 4 to 5 years. And the admission process to come to the US as a refugee is so complex and so thorough, it's probably the hardest way and the slowest way to come into the United States. So this is just a little map of sort of the steps in the process. And it takes, if you see this slide, those are all the US agencies, Department of Homeland Security, just so many of the US government agencies that are part of the vetting process, that it will take years, 4, 5, 6, 10 years, for a refugee from the moment they start the process to the moment they actually have an airline ticket to come to the US. And I remember when I was working in the camps in Rwanda, I think it was a monthly, there was a big bulletin board. And they would print out, unlike the old computer paper with the things on the side, they would print out these sheets and unfold them and then pin them on the bulletin board. And because that was the list of people who after 10, 15, 20 years, because those camps had been there for decades, would see their name on a list. And so every month, everybody would sort of rush towards this bulletin board to see if their name had been hung on the list, because they had gone through the vetting process. 8 years later, 9 years later, they see their name on the board. And then that's when we first hear about them here. So IRC really works from like the moment of displacement all the way over to the moment some refugees find permanent homes in the US. And when that name gets listed on the bulletin board, that's basically when we first hear about them on the US side. So we'll get an email. I mean, this has happened. This morning, we got an email, literally this morning or last night, for our first arrival into Iowa City. We just got the name and the date that they're gonna arrive and notification of their ticket. So that's how we first hear about them. And what we do, what IRC and other resettlement agencies do, is go to the airport and pick up someone who's literally come straight from a refugee camp, in most cases. The Afghan evacuation was a very different scenario, but generally, the refugees who come into the US and those who are coming to Iowa City are straight from a camp where they've been for years. They usually come with one big bag. It's like a very uniform blue bag. And they will come with one bag, and we will pick them up at the airport. And that's their first entry into the U.S. We then start a three-month intensive process of helping them settle into the U.S. So our core services are sort of listed up there. Oh, I didn't do it. Our core services are listed up there for the first 3 months, and that's essentially how much time we have and they have to figure it all out and be up and running and employed, 90 days. So we pick them up, we bring them hot food for the first two or three days. We bring them meals, we buy them groceries, we get them enrolled in English classes, we start to look for housing, which Emerance is working on here in Iowa City, and a variety of other services just to get the kids into schools. And those are some of the things we do for the refugee arrivals. Okay. So these are some of our programs. We do a lot with the First Medical. Many refugees have been, depends, right? It depends. Some of the Syrian refugees, Afghan refugees came from very educated, had moderate to high incomes, et cetera. So they had seen doctors, they had been to the dentist their whole lives. And then you have some refugees who've never been to a dentist, maybe been to the doctor once for like a vaccine. So we do a lot with health assessments when refugees first arrive. Help them again find employment, housing. We do a lot nationally in our other offices with immigration services, so helping apply for citizenship, helping asylum seekers apply, et cetera. People bring family. Everybody wants to bring their family. So if one person is here, we'll help them apply to bring their families so they can be reunited. We also run welcome centers for those crossing the border, so it's almost exclusively undocumented. We have one right across the border in Arizona, which has been a very volatile place, a lot of vitriol and animosity, a lot of racist immigrant hate aimed towards that welcome center on the border, but we do it. And it houses people who have crossed and who have, barely made it. And we help them reestablish, get food, water, and figure out next steps. We also just signed a contract with New York City. There's over 100,000 asylum seekers in New York because it's a sanctuary city, and they can't work legally, they're not allowed to work. And so the IRC is working with the city of New York to help provide services and support to the, I think, 60,000 of the 100,000+ that are in New York City. So we do a lot of exceptional programming based on context and need. Okay. I'm gonna try to wrap it up here. We do community sponsorship. I'm not gonna spend much time on it, but if there are groups in Iowa City, for example, that are interested, I think it's called Welcome US. It's a whole sponsorship program where individuals or groups can sponsor a refugee. A lot of people did it with Ukrainians. We supported a lot of families in Marshalltown, church groups that welcomed Ukrainians. And so it's something, if you're interested as a small group or an individual, you can support a refugee who wants to come to the U.S. And so we do a lot to facilitate that. I'll skip that. Really quickly, and then I'm gonna pass to Amanos. The IRC in Iowa. So we opened in Des Moines in July of, not last year, 2022. So a year and a half. And we just opened in Iowa City, which was amazing and thrilling, and so much support from Sunday and Peter and Mazahir and many members of the community who have been overwhelmingly supportive of IRC doing formal refugee resettlement here. We opened in October, but we just are starting to get our first arrivals now. We expect mostly Congolese because Congolese have mostly been the population coming to Iowa. A lot of Afghans came to Des Moines. There's huge Bosnian populations in Waterloo. So it really depends. Every city in Iowa actually is very different. But we expect Congolese and probably Spanish-speaking populations. We expect more Venezuelans to come this year. We've been told that by the government, who have fled into Colombia. And we'll see. You never know. You don't know until you get the email who they are, how many people, where they're from. So, but that's what we expect. And we've resettled about 330 refugees since we opened. And this year, our aim is 525. So every year, we have to identify how many. This year, in Iowa, we're aiming to resettle 525. And we are one of several in Iowa, so that's not, there's more refugees set to come. But that's what IRC has said for our goal to resettle. So, yeah. Okay, I'm very conscious of time, and I want to pass to Amérance. We have, as you can see from the photo, we have very diverse teams. We look for people with lived experience who speak languages that our refugee populations speak, who have a background in working internationally or in refugee settings. So I think someone said we have 20 plus languages. We have about 25 staff, and we've got 20 plus languages, and I think 8, 9 or 10 nationalities represented. And Amérance is one of our best hires because she's been a long, active member of the Iowa City community, and as Sunday said, has been such a support to newly arriving citizens of Iowa City. And Amérance joined us again a couple months ago to help us kick things off in Iowa City. But we always like to share the stories and experiences of our staff because they often resemble in one way or another some of the experiences as well of the people we're resettling. So I'm going to pass it to you.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and thank you everyone for coming here today. We are very excited presenting IRC to you today. And thank you so much, Sunday and Peter, for having IRC with you today. So my goal today is just to share my story, how I came here in the United States, what brought me here in Iowa City. So I came here with my family, my husband, and four of our children. I mean, I came with four, and then I have 2 here, which makes 6. So 6, you know, we're 8 now. We came here in March 2014. We came through the DV lottery, so which is one of the way to come in United States. If you are now a refugee or asking asylum, you will come by the DV lottery. So as all immigrants, the first thing you try to find is find a work, a place where you can make some money to be able to support your family. That was one thing, but also the main reason that usually that push us to come here, it's to give more opportunity to our kids to go to school, to learn, to have better future instead of what we are facing in our back country. So the first thing we did, besides finding a job to support our family, we first find a school for our kid. It's through the school that I found, I think I met amazing people because at that time I was like at level 0 English. 0. So the lady who was the student family advocate at that time was using Google. She would speak, and the Google would translate for me. I would speak in French, and the Google would do the same thing. He was not very exactly what she would say, but with little knowledge of some words of English from back country. We tried to figure out what she's saying, what I'm saying, and we went together. And that was my first experience meeting with an American community. And after my kid went to school, one day the lady asked me if I would like to take some English classes. I said yes. And she said, if you can find 10 more people, I will make a class here in this school just for adult people. And I was like, I can do it. I can do it. And I found some people, friends that I knew in my area. And we start the English class at Wood at that time. So that was the beginning of everything, how people had to know me, and ask me for support. I didn't know anything, but my only contact was the school, that lady, that student family of God, that was helping me. So all the time I have questions for my people that cannot like meet them or communicate with them, I will talk to this lady, and that was the beginning for me to be known in the community that if you need help, find this lady. If you need help, find her. That was it. That was the beginning. So after that, I was very encouraged to my first English teacher. She told me, you need to go to school. You'll be good for your community. And I went to Kirkwood. I got my class, my English class. And in 2019, I was graduated from Kirkwood community. And working, and that time I was still working with the warehouse, and I was feeling like that I need to switch, I need to go somewhere, that I need to hear people speaking the language of this country instead of staying in the warehouse. You meet your friends, you talk, you still talk the same language, something like that. That didn't help a lot, because I think integration need also communication and learning of the if you learn one language, you need to be practicing talking to people so you can keep it. So that was my next goal. I need to go somewhere where I will be working with people that can speak a different language that's my own language. And I went to do cleaning. I found somewhere to do cleaning. I was the only Congolese at that place, facing everything. Like someone is talking to you, you don't understand. That you have to do it. You have to do something. You don't do it rightly. They will hate on you, but you still learning when they're talking to you. It was kind of frustrating, but we made it. And after that, I was like, I found another job with Goodwill. I was working as a community supporting living, working with people with a disability, going around with them. That was actually very helpful for me because I knew how to buy stuff, like special things, like how to go shopping with American people. It was very learningful for me. I learned a lot from that job. And I think 1 year later, I was still in touch with the school district, and one of the people who knows me there told me, like, there is an opening, like, at the school district that will fit you very well because you know how to work with your community, help them to go to the hospital, get appointments, take them to school. That will be good for you, and you should apply for that. I applied for that job, and I was hired a couple months later. So I've been in this position about 4 years, and here I am in IRC. For me, it's okay. For me, being here in IRC, I think will help me be very efficient helping my community. I know that I've been very helpful to them. But I think now, as I said during my interview, I told Sarah, like, now I'm not only working with Congolese people, but I'm working with more than Congolese people. Because I know it's not only Congolese people, as you heard here. It's not only Congolese people coming here. There is more people that need help, that need our support, because we know how to do it. We know how to register to school. We can tell them, and we can make their life a little bit better than where they are coming from.
Wow.
Beautiful stories of resilience on both sides, of somebody who would leave the country and go to another country and help others, and somebody who comes from another country, adjust to the culture, and be of help to people who are coming newly. We got into the question and answer sessions now. For those of you who have questions, you can raise your hand, and I will bring a microphone to you. Yes.
As I'm a piano teacher, I'm interested in what musical opportunities refugees have.
You can answer too. We'll both answer. I think immediately of an example where we started a band in the camp in Rwanda, because they'd all been there. They were so bored. They couldn't work. They had no prospects. They had no hope. It was just terrible. And so I had a great staff member who tried to create events and activities and new things to do. And we got funding, we had a tiny pot of money to build a playground, and we had to teach the kids how to play. They had never seen a slide, they had never seen swings, and we started a rock band. They wanted a rock band. And so we got a little amp, and they would do their jam sessions in the camp, in the refugee camp. But that was exceptional, that's an example that comes out, but it's very hard, you know, you barely have food in some circumstances, so not a lot of opportunity to,
I think that's true. As Sarah said, if you don't have food, you don't know where to go, you don't have anything like that can keep your mind away from what you're seeing in front of you, I think it's very rare. But it's true that people can sing mostly mom, when they are carrying their baby, maybe to help them stop crying or do something, then they will be singing. It's mostly those kind of things.
Just a quick question. But first, I want to say, Sarah Amarantz, thank you so very much for this excellent presentation, and we are so very happy to have IRC in our community. My question is about one of the slides that you showed us. If I'm not mistaken, Des Moines and Iowa is really the only state in the Midwest with an IRC office. Is that right? At least as I saw it on the map. And I'm struck by how unique that is. Did not see one in Illinois, in the Chicago area, for example. And I'm wondering if you might speak for a moment about what having IRC in the Midwest, in this region of the country, means for operations for the organization.
Yeah. I was thrilled because, when I started working with IRC 12, 13 years ago, internationally, I never in a million years would have imagined I'd be sitting here working for the IRC in Iowa. But I'm thrilled. And I think the reason IRC has expanded or is working to expand it is in the Midwest, is because we've recognized that historically it's been concentrated on the coasts, East Coast, West Coast. And those aren't sustainable communities to be a refugee in. You're never going to buy a car. You're never going to own a home. You're going to struggle paycheck to paycheck. And I advocated, and I think a lot of people advocate, to do more in the Midwest. It is safe. There is space. There's security. There is affordable housing. There are good schools. There is a welcoming community. And so I think there's been a very intentional move by IRC to try to do more and to do more in the Midwest. So we have an office in Kansas that's fairly new compared to the older ones. And we just opened in Kentucky, which is in our efforts to get more Midwest.
It's obvious that
IRC is a huge operation. Where do you get your funding?
Yeah, we get a lot from governments. So we get a lot from the federal government, which makes it also very challenging because, again, it's become so politicized, the refugee. That used to be something any politician, it was very generally supported. But in the last 6-7 years, it's become increasingly polarizing.
I think we all understand.
Yes. So, yeah. But we get a lot overseas. We get a lot from other governments, Germany, the UK. And then we get private funding from individuals and from foundations, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to tell you that as a person who used to resettle immigrants and refugees informally and formally now, I think you're doing an amazing job. I know how hard it is to just resettle a family in this community. And whatever you're doing now is just amazing, especially you are resettling people who've been in the camp for a long time, you know? This is need like a lot of effort to educate them about many, many things. Thank you for this opportunity. But I just saw one of the slides say like the Welcome US. Is this the same as the Welcome Corp? Or this is Welcome US is a program for IRC only, like designed by IRC?
No, it's the general. It's the general one that was set up, I guess, with the Afghans and then the Ukrainians have been most of the people who have benefited from it. But no, it's the US, it's the government one that was set up. And the government did something similar in the 70s during Vietnam. So there were a lot of the Vietnamese who were in Iowa came through churches that sponsored them. So it's very similar to that.
How different that's from Welcome Corp, that like five people can sponsor a refugee? Is that the same thing?
It's the same. It's more that we help the sponsors, so like the church group or mm-hmm. the individuals, we help them where they struggle. You know, they don't know how to, you know, public benefits or something like that. We can step in and like provide support. We work with them. It's not really, it's like a supplemental support.
Good morning. My name is Patrick Adu. I'm an international student here in University of Iowa. I wanted to ask a question with regards to the timeline that you spoke about. It takes 5-10 years, and I want to ask specifically about a situation of war. Why does it have to take that long to get people resettled or get them moved instead of hanging around in those places for years? I mean, it will look like the essence of moving will no longer have the required meaning, in my opinion. Why does it have to take that long to get people into safety that they really require?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I don't know why either. But it's because of, I mean, I don't know why it has to be that way. But it the reason it is the U.S. government and the bureaucracy and the administrative wheels of the U.S. government. And I think, again, increasingly so, I think the vetting process has gotten even slower, more rigorous, more painstaking because of so much hatred towards refugee populations. And so there's even more effort to sort of prove these populations are not terrorists, they're not coming here to, you know, attack the US, et cetera. But I think ever since, I think Syria, right? Since then, I think it's gotten even more challenging. And that's just, it's the reality of politics and the US government more so than anything.
Thank you very much for the talk. This is very informative. I have a question about the numbers that you mentioned. You said that Iowa welcomed, was it 350, and the goal is to up it to 525 this year. So what exactly do those numbers refer to? Is it people who have gone through the 90 days and then are in IRC's hands, or what sort of what exactly is that?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. So
it's it's the refugees that we'll bring over from camps overseas that we will give those first initial services to. So we kind of have three core programs. One of them is the 90 days where we have to do all the things sort of, learn English, get your kids in school, find a job, et cetera. So it's basically the people that we accept to have sent from like UNHCR internationally that we will help resettle in the United States.
So increasing that number means increasing the resources here or increasing the number of people that you are allowed to bring in through the government? Like what would that, where would that increase?
Both sides, I suppose. We can't increase unless we talk to the community. We had dozens of meetings before we opened in Iowa City, for example, to make sure can the schools welcome another, X number of children who don't speak English? Can the University of Iowa, for example, do they have the capacity to do health screenings and then treat complex medical cases a lot of the time? And if they do, if we can tick those boxes, then there's the local capacity, and then we have the capacity to bring them and then have the community support. Yeah.
This is a little more specific, but earlier you talked about how you're having, increasing numbers of, climate migrants and refugees and stuff. I'm not an expert, obviously, but I think that, climate migrants aren't yet awarded the same protections internationally as refugees and asylum seekers and stuff. So has that hampered your efforts to help these people out?
It's harder to sort of define when you're supporting someone who's left because of climate, but it's absolutely happening. And Northeast Nigeria, we worked in Northeast Nigeria. There was the Boko Haram terrorist group that displaced a lot of people. And it's Sahel. It's the Sahel. We had to dig, it was miles to hit the water, what do you call it? The water table. And it was only getting worse. The Sahel part and the water was going down. So these were populations that had fled violence, and you're in an increasingly hostile environment to grow produce, to have access to water. We had to wait months because we had to bring in a special, huge auger, and it took weeks of just drilling down, and then finally they hit the water table. But that's how challenging it was because climate is exacerbating existing difficulties.
So it's
usually
in conjunction with...
Yeah.
Two short ones. Does the state of Iowa government fund IRC or refugee help, and is there any thought of expanding the humanitarian parolee program? I know that's a political question, but those are my questions.
Yeah. So the state does fund us. Yeah. Not as much as some of other states do. It's also because of Governor Robert Ray. I never knew this till I came back to Iowa. Because Robert Ray was such a, he welcomed the refugee, the Vietnamese refugees, and Iowa was the first state to do it in the 70s. And Robert Ray is still known for having done that and been the leader, and he was a Republican. And so Iowa was very unique in that the state of Iowa implemented refugee resettlement when the Vietnamese came. And so there's this long history that's very unique to Iowa and how they fund partners. But yes, we receive money from the state. Yes. And what was the second?
The expansion of the humanitarian parole.
Oh, yes.
Program. Should it happen? And I guess it's a political question.
I think the parolee program is problematic in a lot of ways because it's temporary. And so you have no pathway to citizenship or permanent legal status. You're basically on this rotation every 2 or 3 years that you have to reapply for parole and be allowed to stay in the U.S. And some people are here for a decade or more, and they never can legally stay, and they never know if their parolee status will be renewed. So I think it's one of those complex, you know, situations on how you provide services to populations that are not meant to stay here, you know, permanently.
After this, yeah. I'll take just one more question.
Thank you both for sharing. What are the most important things that employers can do to be welcoming and accommodating to refugees who are seeking to be hired?
Yeah, I will answer to that one.
That hit me.
Like, providing interpretation would be the best thing. Because you have people who come here, they have ability to work, but the only barrier is the language. They can do everything that you want them to do. They can go to the factory. But there is still some place like warehouse. They don't allow people only because they don't speak a little bit of English. So if they can open this, like give that opportunity to have like an interpreter to help people to understand, do the orientation, I think that would make most of the people, our newcomer life, easier.
I think I understand that you received the new folks through the government.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is, you mentioned there are several resettlement organizations. Mm-hmm. What are those in Iowa, and do you all coordinate or work together?
Yeah. There's nine resettlement agencies across the U.S. IRC is one. There are four or maybe five, because they work also like Omaha, Council Bluffs, they kind of cross the border. But there are four main ones, which are Catholic Charities, Lutheran Services of Iowa, and USCRI, United States Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, I believe is the full name. And all four of us are in Des Moines, which gets a little crowded for the size of Des Moines, and to have four resettlement agencies is actually a lot. And I worked in Northern California and in Wichita before coming here. And Iowa was by far and away the most collaborative, warm, as far as working with other organizations. Because you can see us as competitors. We're trying to get the same meager resources. And sometimes it gets a little tense. But it's been a really positive network in Iowa. And we're the first resettlement agency in Iowa City. So, yeah.
Can you give me a minute?
Could you put a post just, if we have steps or resources?
Oh,
yes.
Could I?
Yeah.
Oh.
We're not doing it.
Could I? Yes, and that's sort of how I wanted to end it with. Oh, wait a minute. Here. There you go. So there's ways you can help. Donations. Of like items, household items. Mm-hmm. We have to set up housing. They need beds, they need sheets, they need spoons, they need everything. And we can't buy all of that. We don't get enough money to do it. We need volunteers to do like transfers, drive people to their health appointments, and teach English classes. So there's lots of opportunities. Let me see. How about that? I'll leave that up if you're interested, but just sorry. Those are some of the ways you could help. And because we're new in Iowa City, we really do need volunteers. If there's church groups that want to do a backpack, back to school, winter coats, mm-hmm. do a household setup where you get together and get everything a family will need to move into a house, we do those sorts of things.
Do we have a drop-off center, or do we have to contact you?
I'd reach out to us, because our office is so new here. We're still getting things like set up in a sort of seamless way. We're not there yet.
And if you want to reach to them and you want their contact, we can give you their contact.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to speak to the last question about another organization that's doing this work in partnership with
yes.
these wonderful folks who are starting up in Iowa City. You might see these flyers, the Immigrant Welcome Network. The IRC is really constrained sometimes in what they can do, in part because of their ties to the federal government and the funding. So a lot of times what happens after those 90 days, maybe 90 days after or a year after, is that refugees will move in an attempt to, you know, continue to resettle. And when they move, they lose all of that support. And so what we get a lot of times, especially here in Iowa, is Iowa has a huge number of what's called secondary refugees. So refugees who have official refugee status but were relocated somewhere else and then come to Iowa City. And so our wonderful Mazahar has started up the Immigrant Welcome Network to try and support those folks who are completely off the radar of any kind of agency.
And not only refugees, we resettle new immigrants who arrive to Iowa, whether they are came through the diversity visa lottery or they are undocumented or anyone who just came new to Iowa. We created the Immigrant Welcome Network of Johnson County. Our goal is to make to help resettle the newcomer by make them self-sufficient. We rented a house, and this house now in Bredersheim by North Dutch IV. And four-bedroom house. Currently, there is two family live in that house who just came new. And we help them navigate the system where that we find job for them. We register their kids to the school. And now they are ready to move to their own apartment and house on February 1st. We house people for 45 days. And during these 45 days, we work hard to to help them resettle. So the new family that we have is Egyptian family and Sudanese family. They are in the house right now. And by the 1st of February, they will be in their own home. One family get three-bedroom house, and the other family get two-bedroom apartment. Their kids register at the school at Shimmick, and they are now working. Both parents are working. One work at the school district, one at like a childcare. So this is how we make them just like self-sufficient, because this community have a lot of good resources, but not necessarily the people know about it. And also because of language barrier, everything, weather barrier. But the need is really great. Our house is not covering the need. We, in the top of that, we resettle also 7-6 family who are doubling up somewhere. So I hope you go pick up this one from there. And Amarat is in our board of directors too. So please, I don't want to take from your time. Just go and see this. And if you can, you can help many ways. Just go and check our website. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been very interesting. Thank you very much, Sarah and Emerence, for your excellent program today. I think that the kind of questions that have come up and the engagement here shows that this is a very important topic to members of this community. Our next program features speakers Ayman Sharif, Brandy Jensen, and Will Kapp in pursuit of food justice globally and locally. Join us from 12 to 1 on Wednesday, January the 7th, here in the same venue and online too, where our panel will discuss food justice, a social movement ensuring universal access to nutritious, affordable, and culturally appropriate food for all as a growing imperative today. Only by examining the structural disparities of food systems and by becoming prepared to accept a meaningful change can we address the urgency of food insecurity, particularly for communities of color and low-income communities. The Global Food Project in Johnson County, which they will discuss, is one example of how people in Iowa have come together for an inclusive, just, and sustainable way forward. With that, thank you all so much again for joining us today, and we are adjourned.